Campus FM presents a talk in the Works in Progress seminar series entitled Towards an Anthropology of Migrating Screen Culture. What does Walter Benjamin offer in the age of globalization? The talk is delivered by Dr. John Greck, lecturer in international communications at Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, radio audience. Welcome to the third Work in Progress seminar of 2007. Tonight, we have Dr. John Greck, lecturer in international communications at Macquarie University, Sydney, Australia. And the subject of his paper will be Towards an Anthropology of Migrating Screen Culture. What does Walter Benjamin offer in the age of globalization? John is going to explore how the famous literary and social theorist Walter Benjamin can help us understand the way in which audiences encounter screen images, metaphors, tropes, in situations when the audience is actually not necessarily familiar with the idioms of the culture of the screen maker. The background to John's paper is that here in Malta, Maltese have long had the experience of migrating cultures. Also, Maltese have had a great experience of migration themselves and living in other cultures. And therefore, Maltese have had encounters with the film culture of many countries. Well, with that very brief introduction, I want to hand you over to John Greck. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Paul. Well, thank you all for coming this evening. I hope that you'll find the paper provides some stimulating points to discuss. I hope also that none of you have come expecting that I'll be talking specifically on Benjamin. What the paper does, what the paper I'll be presenting tonight does, is apply Benjaminian thought, my interpretations of Benjamin, which I developed through my PhD research, on a series of problems that I encountered when I was living in Holland in particular, and encountering works on screen projected in languages, and I'm going to speak very specifically about languages, that I didn't always have a very strong, or in fact most of the time had a very poor or no command over. So it's about that engagement of the migrant, if you like, between them and foreign language screens. Okay, so this paper is about the stories being told through and on the screen. It is also about the movement of those stories and the mobility of the screen upon which they are projected. No longer bound by the fireside ritual or ancient open-air auditorium, stories now migrate across vast terrains. The aims and objectives of the paper is to ask whether the idea of story is, as it is considered, say, in terms of mainstream film narratives, is as important as it appears. In doing so, I contrast conventional ideas of what it means to write for the screen with an idea of writing on the screen. My aim is to consider and include the work of audiences, especially immigrant and, in particular, illegal immigrant audiences, as makers of meaning alongside the screenwriter as a producer of work on the screen. And when I'm talking about the illegal immigrant, I'm actually going to be talking about someone who is engaging with codes from a non-initiated point of view. So they're actually, their engagement, their mode of engagement is actually breaking all of the rules of the codes. And in that sense is what I mean by someone who is being illegal. In rethinking the screen in terms of immigrant culture, the screenplay breaks free of what Frederick Jamison describes as the story's arrival as, and I quote here, always already read text. For irrespective of the intrinsic qualities of a screenplay, its language, style, genre, and mode of storytelling, something happens when humans encounter texts and engage with them. Even if they are not familiar with the language of the work, people produce meaning. A tendency, some suggest, is a basic human quality. However, as communication theorists have argued, people pay scant regard to the intentions of the text's producer in arriving at their meaningful interpretations of that work. Now, the independent existence of texts has gradually become clearer over time. As early as the 16th century, Michel de Montaigne writes that, and I quote, "The work by its own force and fortune may second the workman, and sometimes outstrip him beyond his invention and knowledge." During the 20th century, a more comprehensive examination of the independence of a work was published by Wimsatt and Beardsley in 1954. Now, in my view, both de Montaigne and Wimsatt and Beardsley give too much credit to the formal existence of the text while ignoring the role of the audience. The audience's role was first hinted at by Ferdinand de Saussure's Cours de Linguistique Générale, where he draws attention to the unreliability of authorial intent in negotiating the meaning of a particular work. Roland Barthes continued to develop this argument in The Death of the Author, where he announces the birth of the reader. My focus is on the meanings that works on screen produce, rather than the stories the writer wants to tell. This is not to say that the roles of screenwriter, the plot, or the story are reduced. Rather, I'm interested in understanding what happens when screenplays move beyond the context of production and distribution. This is a mark of a society that has become so mediated by reproductive technology that access to a text can no longer be guaranteed, controlled, or predicted, even though a range of intrinsic as well as extrinsic gatekeeping functions can limit the openness and availability of a particular text. Although techniques and technologies such as censorship, language, and the channel of communication can limit the interpretive possibilities of a text, I nevertheless disagree with Tony Bennett's approach, in which he portrays audiences as passive receptors in order to emphasize the role of institutions such as museums in governing the meaning of artifacts. Now, the context of the investigation that I'm going to present tonight is watching foreign language films. My experience of living in Amsterdam provides a quantity of empirical evidence of watching films from different parts of the world whilst living in a diasporic linguistic environment. This context is as typical as it can be of migrant forms of reception in which individuals encounter films exhibited either without subtitles or, if subtitles are present, are in languages that the viewer doesn't fully understand. My own particular diaspora can be defined by having principally lived in an English-speaking environment, although my linguistic background, Maltese, also situates me at an intersection between European and non-European languages. Perhaps it might also appear important to say that my experience in media production gave me an advantage in understanding how films work. Dismissing this discussion on the grounds of the privileged position I occupy would, however, ignore the experiences of many immigrants who, while lacking familiarity with media production and scholarship, nevertheless continue to encounter screen texts in a vast array of linguistic settings and who seem to understand the meaning of the text that they encounter. I begin by distinguishing three types of screen storytelling: mainstream or Hollywood stories, didactic storytelling, and artistic stories. I will then look at the different tasks these different story types ask their audience to perform. There is a broad consensus amongst authors of screenwriting books that good screenplays are structured along narrative lines long ago delineated by Aristotle, a simple structure comprising of a beginning, middle, and end. This is now the basis of mainstream screen production. In addition, there are expectations that a good story contains identifiable characters who motivate the drama in the screenplay. Character motivation is sometimes articulated as, and I quote, Somebody wants something badly and is having difficulty getting it. End quote. Another feature of mainstream storytelling is the ego of the central character in the screenplay, therefore. As a rule, the story depends on a strong and positive identification between the audience and the character. The development and resolution of the story then fulfills the desires established by that relationship. The character gains or fails in their goal. The underlying assumption is that the stories work best when audiences identify with the character and the way that they have chosen to resolve their problem. Life in such storytelling techniques is about establishing goals or ambitions and, in the case of the successful hero, attaining them. However, a goal-oriented, ego-focused story leaves little scope for dealing with or incorporating the actual experiences of the audience's daily lives. For most people, go through life without specific goals that define their existence, without definitive ambitions that they want to realize. And just as people rarely construct their lives in terms of a beginning, middle, and end. Indeed, many refuse to consider that their life will ever end. Arguably, then, what such stories do is to teach audiences how to structure life dramatically according to the rules established by Aristotle. The second category, didactic storytelling, have been documented by mythographers such as Vladimir Propp in The Morphology of Folklore. Folk tales can often be considered in terms of the lessons they teach the listener. While such didactic stories may follow the same structural progression of beginning, middle, and end, the protagonist's motives are not always as clearly defined as they are in mainstream screenplays. Nor might the character's personal motivation be the main driver of the story. Personal gain, ambition, or achievement are subsumed within the stories and remain incidental to the lesson being taught. Another feature of folk tales is that they are often specific to a cultural context, and transmission into different cultural domains can be difficult. Screenplays like Steven Spielberg's E.T. and Wolfgang Peterson's The Neverending Story have successfully traversed a range of screen cultures by enlivening, what they have apparently identified as universal themes. Yet there is still an unanswerable question over the sort of narrativizing function such screenplays perform. Do such films merely educate their audiences into the reception of their characters' tales, or is there something truly universal pertaining to the way they describe humanity? The success of films like E.T. and The Neverending Story is linked to the modes of capitalist production, nevertheless. As Walter Benjamin suggests in the work of Art of the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, such stories, quote, habituate, end quote, individuals to relate to the world in particular ways, even though the adoption of those relationships may actually work to disadvantage those individuals. The third type of story is what I will call artistic stories. Now, against the earlier two categories, one comes across another form of storytelling on the screen, usually subsumed under an all-encompassing but inadequate family name called art. This is a class of screenplay in which notions of narrative structure, storytelling style, genre, didactic purpose, character motivation, thematic questions, and storytelling theses may no longer apply. Each work in this family can be so unique that it becomes exemplary, a category and a genre unto itself. The fragmentary, unclassifiable class of classes of the work of art and the subjects that each member of this family articulates calls for specifically situated responses, specifically situated interpretations, and specifically situated analyses to each work, and sometimes even to each screening. Art can develop not only unique narratives, but each work in itself can inaugurate and incorporate a way of telling that becomes unique and unrepeated, and even unrepeatable. The classification of screen art does not result in a category in which other works can be approached and treated as a family. What it indicates is the difficulty in placing screen works within a formalized and formulaic category that reproduces certain aspects of style, genre, storytelling technique, and approaches. Yet while art may accord more closely with actual experience in everyday life, the work it does, both on and off the screen, demands intense engagement. This engagement insists on acknowledging each unique aspect of the narrative in order to appreciate and understand what a story actually communicates. The three general classes indicated above creates different reception positions for their audience. In the first category, the main goal is to entertain people, as a goal often underpinned by a need to generate profit from the production. For the individual, the effect of mainstream screenplays does not rely on their active participation, but rather such works try to gratify their expectations by demanding nothing from them. Mainstream screenplays do this by providing novel situations in which the hero on the screen tries to solve a problem in new, entertaining, interesting, or unexpected ways. As Benjamin suggests, audiences of mainstream productions are generally passive judges who sit as critics over what is presented to them. In general, there is no lasting meaning or effect such works seek to establish. Rather, they strike for transitory gratification, a gripping thriller, a good belly laugh, a sense of being entertained. The folk tale, arguably one of the oldest forms of storytelling, is didactic and seeks to establish a framework of meaningful significance that stays with the viewer for a longer period of time. The audience of folk tales are expected to be active receptors of what is being communicated. Such educational stories can have a lasting impact, producing outcomes that individually can usefully draw upon during their entire life. However, a limitation of didactic storytelling is that it must enculturate the recipient so that the values of the story portrays are perceived as important and significant, and the solutions presented believable. This may sometimes mean that individuals abandon their own strategies in dealing with similar situations and adopt those presented by the tale. There are many effective techniques that are available to the screenwriter to achieve this, as many propaganda films demonstrate. However, as with all educational projects, there is a problem with such screenplays that such screenplays must control and manipulate their audience. And they tend to be paternalistic as well, and hence to position the experience of the storyteller over and above that of the audience. The third form of narrative, that of the house of art, is more difficult to generalize because, as already noted, this class of screenwriting characteristically lacks uniformity. There is no overarching sign that give the members of this family a sense of belonging to each other. Even the production of meaning cannot be taken or spoken of as generic here. What a successful interaction and reception of an artistic screen work does, however, is to specifically draw upon the experience of the person who encounters it. Only some artworks succeed in doing this, while many fail. Although, of course, an art film that fails for one person may succeed for another. However, the art films that do work create conditions under which meaning is sourced in the individual's reality. A work of art is a rich and fertile terrain, a text upon which the individual in the audience finds significance, as well as self-reflection, and so too the possibility of situating themselves and their experiences within those screen events. While this does not guarantee that the work will have a lasting impact on the individual, there are reasonable prospects that this can occur. Yet, even if a lasting effect is not achieved, enabling the individual to gain a momentarily a critical distance from their world in the present by allowing them to project their reality onto the screen suggests that it should still be regarded as a highly effective and affective work of art. Now, in the third section, I considered the role of language, let's call it screen language, and the impact of migrant communicative interventions on native linguistic codes. In discussions about the screen, language usually refers to the entire semiotic field surrounding screen culture. All the codes of signification used in communicating on and through the screen are important in discussions around screen storytelling. I will focus on the actual spoken and written languages people use when writing for the screen. In this discussion, then, I am generally limiting the idea of language to its conventional understanding, a tool that produces oral written texts that facilitate communication through a medium. I also distinguish two types of encounters with the screen. The first, in which audiences are both familiar with and respond to the depiction of events on the screen in ways that they are expected to. This is the mode of reception predicted by the producers who devised the languages and codes deployed by that particular screen production. The second is a mode of reception that was not expected, nor could it have been predicted by those producers. This is a situation in which audiences interpret events on screen in ways that breaks loose from the meanings the screenwriters sought to establish and transmit. In these reception situations, nearly all the languages and codes of a production may fail. Not only does the language of the dialogues and script, but also the languages of the screen itself, as well as the codes that govern its reception, fail to inform the audience of the way the work should be approached. This can happen either when an audience is not sufficiently competent in the languages and codes employed by that work, or because they do not recognize the codes of that mode of communication, such as when someone does not distinguish between, say, a mockumentary and a documentary. However, I will concentrate on situations in which the breakdown of the language is due to an audience's lack of linguistic competence in understanding dialogues and the scripting of the screenplay. This is a situation commonly experienced by migrants. My object is to identify when and how individuals in the audience can overturn the communication system of a screenplay seeks to establish, and when such audiences create entirely new and hitherto unidentified reception positions. I became aware of this phenomenon while living in Amsterdam when I encountered productions screened in languages that either I did not speak or where I had only limited linguistic competence. During this time, the films I watched had either Dutch subtitles or were spoken in Dutch. As I became accustomed to watching films in foreign tongues, I found I could still interpret the work, and in those interpretations, I was able to give them meaning. As my confidence to interpret different films grew, I realized I could interpret films from a wide variety of languages, from Dutch to Russian, Swedish, German, Italian, and French, to Japanese, Chinese, Iranian, and Afghani. I remember feeling particularly satisfied when I saw Alfonso Cuarón's Ima Itu Mama Tambien and understood what the film was trying to do, or I think I do. Although a growing competence in Dutch, accompanied by the interlinguistic skills my native mother tongue Maltese helped improve my receptivity to Dutch screen culture, I nonetheless found that my capacity to reinvent the stories being told on the screen did differ depending on which families the languages of the films I was watching belonged to. I therefore qualify the analyses I'm about to develop, for it seems that the capacity to engage meaningfully with the screen still depends partially on a capacity to at least gain a toehold in the discursive domain of a particular screen production. Gaining such a toehold depends entirely on the relative proximity between the languages of the recipient and the languages deployed on the screen. I'll begin with a reference to a very interesting talk that Kevin Robbins gave at a cultural studies conference in Istanbul in July last year. In this talk, Robbins attempted to show how migrants watched and received films and television in the language of their host community. In particular, he was looking at the way Turkish communities were understanding and integrating or engaging with films in a German context. Robbins argued that it is possible to analyze what I too had experienced in the 6 years I was living and watching the screen in a multilingual, multicultural context in Holland. The most salient point was his observation that many migrants had only limited linguistic access to the screen cultures that they were encountering. And yet so many migrants, who are often also illegal, poor, lacking in both formal education, professional qualifications, as well as training in media and communications, still spent a great deal of time watching film and television programs in languages they simply didn't understand. This languagelessness in the diaspora, this exile from one's own language, and at the same time, exclusion from the native tongue of the local community fascinates me. And yet, this also defies conventional understanding of what happens when people look at works on screen. I venture forth the following tentative ideas to try to understand what might be happening when non-native speakers encounter a work in a foreign tongue. The first thing that should be said is that, in spite of some native speakers' objections to the interventions of the Fremdlingen, stranger, strangers to a local dialect nevertheless seek to, and whenever they can, participate in the process of communication, even if that is taking place in the most intellectually profound and socially exclusive language and reality games. Indeed, depending on the openness of the local communication network, interventions by migrants can sometimes revise linguistic relations between local dialects and the world they purport to represent. This can affect the native tongue so profoundly that it transforms it altogether, perhaps showing scant or even no regard for the communicational intention, assumptions, and understanding of the originating message. This may sometimes cause those who regard themselves as owners of that message, or the tongue in which it is uttered, to become hostile. Migrant permutations of local dialect can confront the native speaker with a serious problem. How to take migrant interpretations legitimately and incorporate them into a local discourse when migrants fail to maintain respect for the integrity of the original speaker's tongue. Incredulously, as it might appear to native speakers, migrants sometimes refuse or even reject attempts to be incorporated into local language games, games that form the basis of reality in a host culture, not to mention the bonds and relations between individuals in that society and the rest of the world. Like tourists and other travellers, migrants can slip through the intricate nets that ensnare native speakers into reproducing the dictated meanings of a particular linguistic expression. Indeed, strangers require native speakers to accept a state of exception if their communication acts are going to be accommodated. Although this state is only temporary when tourists seek to communicate with native speakers, it threatens to permanently undermine the values and even sense of identity of a host community if a migrant continually refuses to adapt to the local language games of a local society. I shall now define this notion of this state of exception before returning to consider the impact of migrant translations on native discourse and culture. In The State of Exception, Giorgio Agamben describes the suspension of law and the rights that law confers to individuals so that the state can appoint a dictator who will bring about the restoration of the orderly processes of the state that the state itself has suspended. In the English-speaking world, this is usually regarded as a state of emergency. I suggest that this is a good conceptual framework to examine what happens when migrants interpret a native's discourse. And what I'm also suggesting is that migrants can instigate their own state of exception when an individual claims the right to communicate in ways that contravene the linguistic codes that govern communication in a particular social setting. The legitimacy of the migrant's state of exception rests on a claim that it is founded on the individual's sovereign need to participate authentically in the communication practices of that particular culture. The first feature of the migrant's state of exception is that it can be called upon by an individual who claims exception to a localized linguistic order. The acceptance of this state of exception also signals that a host community is open and hospitable towards that individual. The locus of the migrant state of exception is thus the aberrant individual. And the acceptance of that aberrant individual's call to exception represents a generosity and willingness by the community around them to facilitate their communicative inclusion. Now let me digress for a moment and deal with the notion of authenticity in common language here. Raymond Williams has argued that for linguistic expressions to become grounded in the living experience of the communicant, communication and belief must be mutually reflexive. For communication through a common language to remain authentic, therefore, a common language must allow those who participate in its processes to express themselves and, more importantly, become the sources of what they express, in contradistinction to acting as agents for received ideas and governing linguistic strategies. Williams concludes that function and intention are not only openly declared, but commonly approved and controlled. Language and communication becomes a collective source, and he who participates in the act of communication will observe the standards of such an expression if what he is required to transmit is such that he can wholly acknowledge and accept it, to recreate it in his own person. Any practical denial of the relation between conviction and communication, between experience and expression, is morally damaging alike to the individual and to the common language. What this means is that in terms of decoding and attributing meaning to stories on the screen, Williams believed that the individual's sovereign speech can only be said to authenticate that individual's expression once it is grounded in the individual's living experience. If Williams is correct about this notion of authenticity, then migrant interventions into the language games of a particular screening culture become crucial. This is because the state of exception migrants bring about gives rise to utterances that transform the intention and even the process of communication into new and sometimes novel representations and interpretations of a life world not before imagined. In spite of the denial of the migrants' access to the culture in which they are acting, a denial that may be due to nothing more than that individual's lack of command over the linguistic codes of that culture, a migrant can, nevertheless, continue to claim the right to draw meaningful associations between their experiences and the language their host culture uses, including that which it is possible to express in a local dialect. When strangers insist on retaining the authenticity of such expressions and experiences, both on and off the screen, and even if that expression is articulated in a language that is so foreign to that of the screening culture that it brings about the state of exception, the laws governing the production of meaning are thrown into chaos. How a culture responds to this emergency reveals the nature of power, of how that culture enforces law and order on its people. This is when the illegitimacy of immigrant speech can result in a state of freedom that has the capacity to empower individuals, whether native or otherwise, to challenge rather than reinforce, to rework rather than reproduce the governing structures of a particular discourse. And this is also when a governing order is tempted to call a state of emergency. The contact zones that are created when migrants engage with a language of a host culture might best be considered a contamination area in which the skin of the screen and the skin of the audience are irreparably wounded. With organs spilling forth from permanently open bodies, a zone of contamination becomes a transformational abyss, an interstice in which an unholy union between heterogeneous bodies, text and audience, language and experience, that brings about what Benjamin describes as a monstrous abomination of the translation. Such translation takes it upon itself to reform not just the linguistic codes and structures that govern an act of communication, but even the possibility of what that language act signifies and means. In making their noticeable difference present, immigrants claim the right to both suspend existing linguistic codes and practices, as well as the freedom to create new forms of dialogues and discourse. I now want to explore what Benjamin sees in the notion of translation a little further. In The Task of a Translator, Benjamin develops a theory that demonstrates how translation evolves the language of the translator. Benjamin uses the term pure language to describe this evolutionary process, but makes it clear that the realization of pure language remains unattainable. For it is a projection on a horizon that always recedes from the present state of language. As Benjamin explains, the reason language must evolve but never reaches its ultimate state of perfection, of purity, is that life itself continues to evolve, and in that evolution, life never fails to transform itself into new and innovative forms, sometimes beyond recognition. According to Benjamin, the task of the writer writing in their native tongue is to use language to articulate and express such novel living experiences so that others may reflect on their own experiences of similar events. The task of the translation, on the other hand, is to make available the effect on language, as Benjamin calls it, a particular effect that has on a tongue of its original utterance, into different languages. Yet the paucity of language becomes evident in the limited capacity that linguistic expressions have in representing life to others. This paucity is further highlighted as life continually finds new and innovative ways of expressing itself. So language must continually find new and innovative ways of expressing living emergencies. Benjamin concludes that the introduction of new forms of linguistic expression, which he thinks takes place through translation, is the work translation does for the evolution of language. I suggest that we can approach the work of immigrant interpretations of screenplays in these terms. In so doing, we identify both a role for immigrant cultures in their host communities, whether they are deemed to be legal or illegal, as well as the contribution their translations make to the evolution of screen and other cultural discourses. Migrant translations evolve our languages by importing linguistic expressions of life into discourses that otherwise do not possess such expressive potentialities. Although the natural flow of translation is normally to wholly move a text from one cultural-linguistic location into another, a migrant moves their translation in two ways. First, they move it towards the cultural and linguistic location that is their origin, which they do in order to understand the text. But then, the migrant returns that translation back into the cultural and linguistic context of the text's origin. In this double movement that stops, it is this double movement that stops immigrant translations from becoming inculcated in the host culture's attempts to colonize the stranger. And it is also this double movement that Benjamin sees as necessary for the evolution of language to take place. However, to natives of the hosting screening culture, the migrant's translation may appear to be a distorted, pigeon-like imitation of something that the migrant has not fully understood. At worst, a migrant's translation may come to be regarded as a mockery of the native structures of meaning and signification. Illegitimate migrant translations that reinterpret and return a text to its point of origin can thus be seen to pose even greater threats of interrupting the cultural flows that embody the social bonds and cultural relations that govern the production of meaning of the migrant's hosting culture or community. Yet what native speakers mistake as an imitation and abomination is actually the originality of the migrant's self-authenticating recreation of a work into a world within which they live. Offended by what is perceived as transgressive acts of distortion, native speakers patronize, summarily dismiss, and sometimes attack migrant interventions as aggressive and invasive interlocutions founded on ignorance, stupidity, inadequate education, or poor acculturation. Compromised by structures of the native stronghold, the legitimacy of the migrant expression are normally constrained. The host culture alone can decide whether to rehabilitate a migrant's deviant ways by giving a migrant the opportunity to become educated and corrected so as to reflect the values of their host community. Just as the host community alone decides when to reject and sometimes even expel the migrant altogether. Now, it might be argued that illegal immigrant expressions should expect nothing more than their exclusion from participation in a native cultural discourse, whether we speak of everyday discourses or discourses on the screen. However, once a migrant, whether legal or otherwise, draws attention to deficiencies in the signifying links of our communicative system, a state of emergency might be declared to incorporate the immigrant's expressions. When a host culture defines itself as being tolerant, such as Dutch society does, for example, such cultures seek to situate and legitimize the migrant's speech in ways that no longer threaten the internal values underpinning the bonds and relations between signs and what they mean. Thus, the preservation of the local orders of discourse is guaranteed. A linguistic state of exception, which when activated by a migrant, traumatizes representations of events to such an extent that such events cannot be reconciled within existing social structures. In fact, such interventions may require a new negotiation of social bonds and cultural relations, and the meanings they produce. Such ruptures become particularly evident in the catastrophic collisions between different linguistic systems and different cultural values. For this reason, migrant readings of native culture, whether public or private, will always challenge the hegemony of cultural discourse. Now, in concluding, I want to finish off on three points relating to the notion of education, migrating screen culture, and what I call recursive narrative dialogue. The act and impact of immigration, both legal and, more importantly, illegal, can never be fully quantified, qualified, or theorized into a static discourse. In as far as this phenomenon is far from being comprehensively understood, I tentatively move forward the following provisions and hope to create a dialogue for considering the work of migrants in reworking ideas concerning screenwriting cultures. 1. Immigrant encounters with the screen creatively reinterpret screen works to produce new and novel meaning not available to natives of an ongoing, of an originating screen culture. Because of their lack of acculturation, immigrants introduce their own frame of reference, experience, values, and systems of belief to underpin their interpretation of a particular work. This means that immigrant interpretations of a screen are less predictable, and the outcomes of communication between screen and audience less stable, and hence less governable, and also less totalizable. However, migrant interpretations remain inherently democratic because immigrant audiences do not limit theirs or others' engagement with the screen to those prescribed and proscribed by the writers of the screened text. The disjunctions between immigrant and native discourses can lead to higher levels of sophisticated, self-reflexive, critical understanding of the workings of screen language and culture. 2. Towards a radical practice in the education of screenwriters and their audience. It is now possible to argue that the production of narratives attributed to or said to represent mainstream culture leads to formulaic styles of writing that educate audiences to perform predictable acts of decoding and interpretation. This establishes and supports the laws and conventions governing the practice of production while regulating the meaning these values can generate. In contradistinction, the production of non-mainstream storytelling results in broader narratives, nuances, complexity, and differences. These reflect directly in the production of community discourses, values, and meanings. It is now possible to argue that the multiplicity produced by a non-classifiable categories of storytelling enable audiences to remain open and more accustomed to negotiating with other cultural discourses. Audiences of non-classifiable narratives are significantly more productive and adaptive in terms of cultural as well as economic outcomes and outputs. Such audiences are significantly advantaged in being able to deal with the exposure to different screening cultures and the uncertainty this brings. And finally, 3, regarding diversity, education, and the cultivation of practical learning. Regular exposure to formulaic modes and styles of storytelling predisposes audiences to progressively become more receptive to the repetitive reproduction of those modes and styles. This form of practical learning habituates audiences into predetermined modes of existence that underpin both individual as well as collective life. Becoming programmed to telling tales about certain things in certain ways, the more practiced audiences become in reproducing things and situating them back into the narrative logics that underpin existing networks of bonds and relations. The more people perform the regulative consumption of formulaic storytelling, the more adept they become in performing similar acts of narration whenever they are confronted by new cultural material. The more programmic the logics of narrating events are, the more inventive people become in converting novel events into familiar formations. On the other hand, screenwriters who expose audiences to unclassifiable forms of narrative enable us to deal with innovative, unique, and original storytelling strategies. languages as well as trajectories. A deprogrammatic practice of storytelling creates logical rationalities that produce unique conclusions based principally or even solely on the particular events plotted by a screenplay. In such scenarios, it is reasonable to expect that the variety of endings, as well as the steps leading up to their conclusions, become more varied. These should continue to expand as each new encounter with the screen supports broader variegations that reconcile each screening with everyday experiences of those who encounter it. This enhances both the diversity and authenticity of meaning in the story. Authentic storytelling for diverse cultures thus expects that the production of the text will be equally met by the writer and those to whom the story is being told. Both collaborate to create the meaning and significance on and off the screen. Now, sender and receiver are legitimated as producers in interpreting and translating events expressed. This allows the stories themselves to remain open, available, and continue to carry the potential to become again meaningful for future generations and for further recursive, migrating interpretations and translations.
John, thank you very much for an extremely wide-ranging theoretical presentation, which it seems to me seeks to look at a number of different issues at once, originating in a program to look at the different possible translations of a film by audiences from different cultures. You then go into the whole issue of the extent to which an audience can resist a common translation and come up with their own translation of the work. And you develop your interesting theory of a state of emergency, or as you call it, a state of exception, in which a foreign culture, in fact, insists upon, in all kinds of ways, its own interpretation. It creates its own meaning from the screen text. This opens up many questions. My own question, very, very briefly, would be the extent to which a foreign audience continues to resist the interpretation of the producer. Because the way I translate or read your theoretical text, I see your discussion of the screen culture of the producer and the host country versus the culture of the immigrant group. I translate this into the whole well-known difference between a hegemonic discourse and a subaltern discourse. And I have always had grave doubts about the possibility of a subaltern discourse continuing to reproduce its own interpretation of a text or a film. Rather, I would see over the long term a process of dovetailing, whereby the immigrant group ends up in a state of silence, which leads eventually to a state of adopting the discourse of the hegemonic group. But of course, I'm translating your text in my own very particular way. This is my hypothesis, and I only come to this hypothesis by listening to your work. That'll be my question, but I'm sure people in the audience, you're clearly looking at issues of education. You're looking at specific issues of screen communication. You're looking at issues of the logic of discourse itself and the link between discourse and action. You're handling many different issues in your paper. That's my particular question. And then I would open it up to the audience.
Well, I think you're right, but I think you're right that migrants, cultures, when they're in a host community, the overriding tendency of a migrant is to integrate within that host community. I mean, migrants don't want to remain part. Nobody, I don't believe, wants to function, or very few people want to function on the outside of the social systems that they're functioning or performing in. So to the extent that migrants want to become part of that governing system, this is true, I think. You're right. They do lose that kind of initial point of absolute difference, if you like, or cataclysmic distanciation. However, what the introduction of the migrant does is it opens or explodes the hegemonic system, at least initially and significantly, if not totally, depending on how much exposure the migrant culture is given. And in that, then, I think there is the prospect that natives within of that culture can start to express their own refinements, if you like, or their own differences in the way that meaning is produced within the native discourse to natives themselves. People all talk about love, for example, what we think of as a fairly commonly understood notion, but very few people would actually agree on how that might be described, at least in language. Friendship also, and lots of other concepts. In fact, every concept creates its own variegation. So at that moment then, depending on the receptivity of a host culture to the to this point of explosion, and the capacity, the faith that that culture has, or the sense of security that that culture has to that explosion, will or may create conditions under which the host culture itself then starts to re-examine its own structures and to reposition itself internally. And this can lead, I believe, to a more sophisticated, a more refined, and hopefully an ongoing, constant re-examination of what we actually mean when we're communicating with each other. However, I must also qualify that by saying that in the present moment, where we are seeing, as Peter Mayo has written in a book called The Globalization of Racism, a reaction against migrant cultures. And this is, I think, based primarily on the enhanced levels of insecurity that many, many cultures are experiencing today. So what we are seeing in reality in the world today is increased hostility towards these interventions, these very, very productive interventions that immigrant cultures have in the host communities that they are in. And I think this is a great tragedy, actually. I think this is limiting the possibilities of what we have and are allowing for ourselves as natives, as well as when we're in the position, as indeed many of us are today, in being migrants or at least temporarily placed in different cultural contexts.
Thanks, John, for an interesting discussion on the making of meaning and the interpretation of meaning. From your own experience in Holland, how does the subaltern, if we can call it subaltern, the different kind of interpretation that immigrants bring into reading a text, screenplay, in a language they don't understand, is it important to know how that interpretation then manifests itself? Because you have just said that the natives themselves can learn from those interpretations, because they themselves will start questioning what they take for granted, the hegemonic culture, mm-hmm. the codes that the hegemonic culture creates mm-hmm. in which the discourse takes place. Mm-hmm. But what are the spaces that are allowed, now in concrete terms, say in a context like Holland, where you've been, for the different interpretations that migrants who don't know the language, and one has to see what the motivation there is. Is it because I don't know the language and this is the only meaning I can make? What happens then when I start gradually getting access to the language? Will my meaning making be conditioned by the hegemonic forces that are there in Dutch society? hence, do I conform in terms of meaning-making, because it's only a question of not having the language? Or do I continue to be resistant because there's something which tells me, my makeup, that even though I may not have, I have only a partial understanding of the language or partial understanding of the new codes, set of codes to which I'm being exposed, there's something which tells me that there is something about myself which authenticates this kind of interpretation.
Yeah, I think the way I take your question is in some ways an extension of what the question that Paul just made. If I'm wrong, I mean, correct me. Yeah. What I think, and I come back to Benjamin on this, you see, I think Benjamin's absolutely correct in saying that we perform language. We don't actually... We perform the codes, we perform the bonds and relations that language establishes in our interaction with the world around us. And in that performance, I think there is still a kind of space for the body. And in this body, there are experiences which the body itself is a kind of receptor and a memorial of. And I think you never eradicate where you've come from to that extent. It's impossible. And it's not so much then about being resistant. I think just the sheer subjectivity of the individual, the fact that they've come from a different cultural location, the fact that they have got a different language, the fact that they have different experiences is going to predispose them to performing even the same codes, the same bonds, the same relations in nuanced ways that are probably going to be innovative and novel, at least in the purer native context. That's what I think. You have some...
it's a theoretical answer to a theoretical question, but I also asked for where are the concrete spaces where these alternative interpretations manifest themselves,
based on
the Dutch experience.
Yeah, the concrete spaces, and I don't want to, I'm kind of reluctant to use myself as the example, but the ways that I performed in Dutch culture, those become the concrete spaces. And in examining those, you, again, I suggest, have to look at the specifics of each individual in the end. And in the end, what this suggests is that the production of knowledge has to be seeped back down to the source of the experience. And from there, then, you start to undermine the Western notion. I think the totalizing notion that Benjamin himself was so very much against, the fascist idea that you can somehow cohere and can make all things conform to a particular statement, a thesis. And when you start to look at the specifics of each individual, which is, of course, empirically a very, very difficult thing to do, then you start to find where those spaces of resistance, if you like, are actually taking place.
I'd like to pick up on Peter's point to ask what strategies of accommodation or perhaps concrete spaces would you discern in, to take an example from television, something like the Kumars at number 42, or Goodness Gracious Me, or perhaps the example of Bollywood cinema in the UK. I think these present possibly interesting cases for discussion and review.
I'm not familiar with those either. I mean, Bollywood I'm more familiar with, but more from an Indian context. The United Kingdom's Indian community has produced some really interesting films that I know, examples like My Beautiful Laundrette and various other films in the 90s that I'm more familiar with. So perhaps you could I ask you to rephrase the question?
Yeah. To take the example of the Kumars at number 42, it returns, ironically, a popular chat show called Parkinson upon the native community, where the hosts are are migrants, who second or third generation migrants, interviewing native celebrities.
Native to the UK?
Native to the UK. Right, and that sets up interesting patterns of irony.
Yeah. Well, I think this is a very interesting that notion of irony. I'll just pick up on that. I think, and particularly when ironic strategies are adopted by migrants, if I can bring it to a context that I know, in Australia, migrants were called, as a derogatory term, wogs by the local community there. And in the 80s and 90s, you saw a rise in particularly comedians, but also other kinds of mediated performances being developed by people, where wogs were calling themselves wogs and actually using these terms, ironically, to both remind the Australian community, who at this time wanted very much to forget that they used such terms to discriminate against certain people, when there were also other larger communities who were then seen as invading the country from Southeast Asia, for example, who posed a much more significant threat today. And the WOGs kind of used their own labelling under the racist conditions that they had experienced as a way of kind of playing, but also seriously challenging the kind of moves of the Australian culture to try to kind of, just forget what happened. And this is something that I think in Australia, for example, has a long history, what we've forgotten about the Aboriginal culture, what we've forgotten about lots of differences in cultures. As Australia seeks to become a melting pot for all of these supposedly, you know, wonderful people coming together and creating a new community, all of whom speak English.
Thanks, John. As I think, as others have said already, I think your piece has just encapsulated so many interesting threads that we could be here until next week unraveling them and asking questions which would take us on different tangents. But my questions are just two very, very simple ones. One was a query, I suppose, about your construction of the migrant. And it struck me that there was an essentialist version of a migrant coming through. And I just wondered if you could expand it a little and reassure me perhaps that it wasn't an essentialist version of a migrant. And secondly, an empirical question about when you talk about your own observations, your own experiences, the subjective experiences, which is always where we start from with research. I was wondering, though, if you had also spoken to other migrants about their experiences of reading texts.
No, actually, in response to the second question, first, I hadn't, and that was why Kevin Robbins' paper in Istanbul was so crucial for me. It proved this was an experience that I'd had personally, and that had always intrigued me at what was going on. But I never really had the sort of theoretical tools to even start to get a handle on it, and I'm not saying I have. But at least I've tried to make a start. And with Robbins, that was my kind of empirical cross-data examination, if you like. What he presented gave me enough kind of reference points in his work to his examination of how Turkish migrants were engaging with television, in particular in Germany, for me to then start to think about the whole question that the experience that I've had posed for me. In terms of the essentialist, the essential migrant experience, is that partially what you're asking?
Well, it just came across in the writings and in the conversations that were ensuing that we seemed to be talking about a type of migrant. We weren't allowing for perhaps the second generation migrant that Ivan refers to through the production of programs like the Kumars, etc. And I was wondering how that, if we were to consider those versions of migrant, whether we'd be getting a different picture of this interpretation of science.
Yeah. I think that's an interesting question, and I think that opens up another.
I don't think that's necessarily an answer.
No. Well, I hope that I'm not being essentialist in what I imagine essentialist is. I'm not trying to pin down the condition of migrancy to some predetermined conditions. However, I do have problems, and I notice this is happening here in Europe more than in a place like Australia, where second and third generation descendants of migrants are still regarded as migrants. I can't see how this can actually be sustained intellectually. I think there has to be something fundamentally wrong, some schism within those cultures who insist on still distinguishing second generation, third generation immigrants or the children of immigrants as being essentially non-natives. I really have a problem with that. That's part of the answer. I really have a problem with the way, for example, that's a little digression, and I'll perhaps return to that. I guess I'm calling upon my own experience as well, and to this extent it probably is essentialist in the way that I have been framing the discussion or my approach to the problems. I don't mean to impose upon that, though, that has to be a precondition. There are many different kinds of migrants. There are many different motivations for different movements of people. I actually think migration is the most natural thing that humans know. It's older than settled communities, in fact. And this is a fundamental quality of human life. And the limitation of migration is actually, in a sense, an impediment against something which ought to be the right of every human being. Of racism.
Of the nation state.
Oh, yes. Well, the nation state is quite a... Yeah. Sorry, Rachel.
Hi. I just wanted to bring in a different example, once we're mentioning the Turkish migrants, for example. I've heard of some work carried out on the Turkish migrants in London, which actually used to import Turkish film to London, where all the Turkish community used to go to meet up mm-hmm. and watch these films. And it used to kind of bring back a sense of home for them. They have Turkish language film for Cypriot Turks and Turks themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if there's anything which you might like to comment. It's a reverse side of the story, kind of. They have the Turkish language films with the Turkish migrants.
What I
in
would
London.
Like to say is, and you see this phenomena actually taking place in many different contexts, not only in London and not only within the Turkish community. What interests me about that scenario is the extent to which migrants, when they're separated from their host, from their originating culture, actually fossilize their ideas of that culture. And again, this is a very, very observable phenomena when returned migrants come back to the place where they departed from, and suddenly their expectations are so they're totally disappointed. You hear about people returning to Malta, for example, and expecting still to see people walking around the streets with donkeys and stuff like that. And I think quite rightly so, the Maltese who are still in Malta get really annoyed when they see this happening. And, all that is to say that migrants undergo a tremendous loss. And they try to hold on to something because it is a really significant part of their being. And those screenings are probably their attempts to do that. Sorry?
Yeah, I was just going to follow up on that because I know from my own research that where we find people locating themselves as migrant groups in another space, whether it's the Islamic or the Turkish community going to watch a film, or whether they're going to an Irish pub to talk to their friends and relations about that bridge space back home, mm-hmm. Those spaces don't change, as you said, they continue to remain frozen in time for that migrant group. And their returning home, or their attempts to return home, our struggle for both the returnee and the returners, yes, because the resistance from both sides seems to be very complex, and probably a whole other dissertation.
Yes.
But it seems to be a repeated phenomenon, yeah, that migrants will locate spaces where they can reenact their homeland, mm-hmm, if you like, whether, yeah, it's through drinking in a pub or through cinema.
It's just a comment on how, you know, the film was usually complemented by performances and singers before the actual show, and, you know, people meeting up, taking their cushions for the children to sleep, and there's a whole performance around the film itself. The film was the focus, but there was a lot happening even on the sidelines, kind of, of the cinema as well.
Can I just thank you for this, because, I mean, listening to the discussion, the kind of spectrum we have here, if you will, the kind of ideal type polarity which is emerging in trying to think over possible examples about applying your theory, is precisely that between the television show in which some form of accommodation is going on, or the comedy show in which words like wog or nigger get pastiched by the subaltern community or the migrant community in such a way as to establish a place and also play on the humor of the majority group on one extreme. But on the other extreme, I keep on thinking of what Rachel has been saying, namely the case of the Turkish film, the case of the Bollywood film, the case of the Notting Hill Film Festival. In other words, to what extent are these listening, producing and receiving cultures in a screen context deciding to remain apart, and to what extent are they negotiating with each other?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think obviously that the scenario there differs given whatever range of scenarios you're looking at. One thing that I was going to refer back to within the Australian Maltese community, one researcher in Australia has come up with a novel term to describe the way that the Maltese language continues to live in a Maltese context, in an Australian context, and they now call it Maltralian. So even these separate communities, these kind of exiled communities, if you like, although they're not, although in some ways they are, continue to evolve within themselves. And these become fertile terrains for study in themselves. I mean, I guess what the question that I'm coming back to, partly as a result of the discussion, is to what extent do we really need to have a sense of our native culture, and why is it that people can't simply move between different cultural realities, which is, I think, what happens anyway when people encounter themselves on the street, even if they are all talking the same tongue, even if they're all, you know, they all understand the codes, there's still nuances there that significantly make gaps between the common reality. At what point, it seems to be a process of extremes, though, and as soon as the gaps reach a certain point, a critical mass, if you like, there seems to be a break, and then suddenly you feel like you're an alien, or the culture feels like it is no longer rooted in its point of origin. I'm interested in that kind of continuum. I do think it is a continuum, though, and I don't think, even though the way that we've been talking about it, and I think part of the reason of this course anyway, is it tends to fix things into these kind of polarized concepts. But in reality, I think these are things that are taking place in a living continuum, and that's what culture is, after all, and language, too, for that matter.
Yeah, I'd like to... Yeah, I bear in mind what you're trying to say, people being border crossers, as how I like to call that.
Yes,
yeah, straddling borders, so to speak. I think that's important, and I think it's important for any country which calls itself democratic and which accommodates immigrants, especially the countries like you and you've come from, and I've lived in one of them, Canada, where there's a multicultural policy there. that they should encourage this kind of thing. What happens, though, is that going back to the film, episode that our colleague has mentioned, the Turkish film, the question I would raise is what kind of film? What kind of Turkish film? Because for me, if it's a recent Turkish film, which actually attests to the organic nature of Turkish culture, cultural production, mm-hmm. that's a positive, and that's something really great. Mm-hmm. And then God knows what the motivations are for watching that film. So it's not for me to say, listen, you know, there's a problem with this. But I think also, what kind of cultural production are we talking about? What does it tell us about Turkish society? Mm-hmm. If it's something recent, for example, if it's something which really shows how dynamic Turkish film production is, well, that's true, because that means they're moving with the... But the flip side to that is that often, if we cling to the fossilized notion of cultures, which could be also reflected in certain types of films, a problem is that that is precisely often what is often encouraged by governments in what I call colonial setups. Mm. Because what I see in Australia, what I saw in Canada, despite all the talk about multiculturalism, and even multiculturalism is a very problematic term, we have to problematize that, is that multiculturalism actually encourages this kind of ghettoization, if you like, this kind of, it's a form of absorption. Mm. It's a form of containment. Mm,
exactly.
Which actually keeps you in that space,
yes.
which is erroneously defined by those in the position of power as ethnic, mm-hmm. as if not everybody is ethnic. Mm-hmm. And it retains a colonial structure whereby people in a position of power define themselves as such in relation to the ethnic other.
Yes. I think that's a very astute analysis, Peter, and I couldn't agree with you more about that. It, in fact, was the point I was trying to make when I was referring to Dutch culture and the way that, you know, migrant interpretations are politely incorporated within mainstream discourse. But it's done so in this kind of exoticized way. It's done in a way that it keeps it discreet. And if somebody from that group really wants to be part of Dutch culture, then they actually have to leave that space and enter what is Dutch space, in a sense. And that sense of Dutch space is still being governed by the powers that underpin that society and the relations that are there and encoded within all of the performances that people are encouraged, at least, to perform.
Perhaps if I could just respond very briefly. Many of the films, in fact, were carried out and screened in the 70s and 80s. And most of them, in fact, were based on love stories, because most of the people interviewed for this documentary, which I'm talking about, were children at the time, so they remember their mothers always crying at these very soppy love stories and so on and so forth. But what's also interesting is that many of these films were actually screened previously amongst the Turkish migrants in Germany, and then through various networks were then imported to London. So there's a whole sort of like sequence of events taking place. Mediations and contacts and networking, you know, because many people used to go and watch the films. Yeah. Not only for the love stories, but also to continue creating and maintaining the various networks amongst the migrant community, the Turkish migrant community in this particular case. Some of them were from Turkish Cyprus, the people who had to flee after the early 70s when there was the division of Cyprus, and others were also Turkish communities as well, Turkish Cypriots. Some of them chose to leave or flee or migrate. There were small groups who usually had to.
Rachel's examples are interesting because Rachel has just been very involved in a Mediterranean-wide multi-country project called Mediterranean Voices, which has been building up a huge database, cybernetic database, and it has been looking at urban milieu in many parts of the Mediterranean, and in fact, she and others in this project, all anthropologists, have been experimenting with short films, and they have been struck by not merely by the problems in making a film about people in an urban milieu, but at being struck by the extent to which people depict themselves, represent themselves, recognize themselves in various ways in film. So we are looking at a multicultural situation being handled or accommodated in very different ways. May I come in here? This is you're giving us a very wide-ranging perspective, a very wide-ranging theoretical perspective, which is fertile because we can each plug into it in different ways and ask you questions from very, very different points of view. But of course, you're working in a challenging way, but also in a very self-reflexive way, as an immigrant yourself in Australia. But I put it to you that it's one thing to be an English-speaking immigrant of Catholic background in an English-speaking Christian, predominantly Christian society, e.g. Australian, yeah, and to be somebody who is either of a different color, yeah, one obvious yeah example, or of a different religion. And here, if I may, I just put this example because I'm worried, getting back to Rachel's example of the Turkish film in London, I'm worried about the extent to which, as you very ably put, accommodation and negotiation, discursive negotiations can go on. On the other hand, there are situations in which the space of resistance obsesses the migrant group, particularly when it comes to film or other forms of vivid representation. And I'm reminded of a work in progress paper we had 2 years ago from Ivan Kalous with us here today, in which he was discussing Derrida's work. What is it possible to say after 9/11? I don't know if Ivan could come in for just a second here. In other words, what kind of discourses were behind 9/11, or what kind of, to put it a bit more clearly, what kind of refusal to communicate, what kind of refusal to engage in discursive accommodation was involved behind 9/11? Thank you very much.
You have just listened to a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled Towards an Anthropology of Migrating Screen Culture, What Does Walter Benjamin Offer in the Age of Globalization? The talk was delivered by Dr. John Greck, lecturer in international communications at Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia.